chapter 7, you get the small Bible, put the next Isaiah 52, 13, 15, with what we see. Is preferable to more customary practice of scholarship in the 20th century, which connects this segment with Isaiah 53. The evidence for this suggestion presented in this paper is the structure of Isaiah 54, 52, particularly of 51, 9, 52, 15, and the conceptual connection of 52, 13, 15 with what precedes. It is not intended to be a study of Isaiah 53. However, answering this question has a motive beyond that of correctly determining the context of Isaiah 52, 13, and 15. Common knowledge that since Boone's commentary produced in the last decade of the 19th century, it has been customary to treat four servant poems in isolation from the best of Isaiah 40, 55. The presenter of this paper agrees with Ackroyd's analysis of this procedure initiated by Boone. Ackroyd says, great damage appears to have been done to the understanding of the message of the prophet in the separating out of four so-called servant psalms from the remainder of the material. They are rather to be set in the main context due to Isaiah's thought, and their interpretation depends upon the full apprehension of his message. Unfortunately, Ackroyd does not, in his subsequent description of the message of Isaiah, indicate precisely how the servant psalms are to be set in the main context of the thought of this prophet. This paper is regarded as a small contribution to the larger task of doing this. Its writer feels that one aspect of this task is the recognition of the proper context of Isaiah 52, 13, 15. In the history of the study of this section of the book of Isaiah, the evidence for regarding Isaiah 52, 13 to 53, 12 as a unit is not as obvious as Boone assumed it was. While I am not confident to fully describe the history of the interpretation of this parenthesis, I think two facts of this history can help to focus our attention on the evidence as it relates to the question we are attempting to answer. The Masoretic division in the thought unit is ambiguous at this point. The Masoretic text printed in Bibliographicae does not mark off Isaiah 52, 13 to 15 from 53, 1 to 12. This seems to represent common practice of the Masoretic. However, the full Isaiah scroll from Qumran does separate 52, 13 and 15 from 53, 1. The division by later transmitters of the text is also ambiguous. Most interpreters of this section treated Isaiah 52, 13 and 53, 12 as a unit. But for some reason, Isaiah 52, 13 to 15 was included with the preceding context when the book of Isaiah was divided into chapters. I think that Eichfeld's discussion of this phenomenon is useful. He, after describing the usefulness of form critical study and describing the literary forms exhibited in the Old Testament, writes, the recognition of the nature of the smallest unit, which we have discussed in the previous sections, is of the greatest importance. In the first place, it makes possible an assured demarcation of the individual narratives, sayings, songs, and the like, and thus achieves the first prerequisite for their proper understanding. The tradition which we possess for such demarcation, that is, the traditional divisions of the text into larger sections, is in fact by no means every word satisfactory and correct, whether we follow the Jewish division into parashot or the division into chapters which appeared in the Vulgate about AD 1200 and from the 14th century onward was gradually adopted in Hebrew manuscripts and printed editions. In some cases, the division into parashot and chapters is correct. In some cases, the chapter division is better than the parashot division. By contrast, the division in the parashot is to be followed and not the chapter division in, for example, the last of the Eliyahu Psalms, Isaiah 52, 13, 53, 12, and in the section Isaiah 63, 7, 64, 11, which we have already noted as a unit, namely the National Song of Lamentation. But there are also cases where both divisions are misleading, and we must make a division according to our own judgment. It is here that the recognition of the type may render excellent service. An analysis of this discussion reveals some useful insights and some discrepancies. I felt first assert that a form critical analysis of a pregnancy is useful in discerning intended thought units in the biblical doctrine. He suggests that the traditional indicators of such thought units, though often useful because they are correct, are not always satisfactory. He gives examples of places where the masoretic divisions are preferable to the chapter divisions, where the chapter divisions are preferable to the parashot divisions, and where both are misleading. In the last case, he suggests that one must use his own judgment in marking off the thought divisions. In the context, it is obvious that he means that this judgment ought to be informed by a form-critical analysis of the curriculum. But in the two examples he uses where the parashot division is preferable to the chapter division, he supplies form-critical evidence for only one, namely 63:7 to 64:11. In this case, I find the form-critical analysis convincing. He offers no evidence for the assertion that parashot division is preferable to the chapter division in Isaiah 52:13-53:12. This suggests that for this example, there is no form critical evidence that supports this preference, and that in a discussion where he is describing the benefits of, yes, the necessity for, form critical research in the demarcation of thought units, he uses an example of proper division that is not at all based on form-critical analysis. In connection with this example, we should be consistent with need to apply his concluding direction, where both traditional divisions are misleading, or the evidence for the propriety of one or the other is ambiguous, we must make a decision according to our own judgment. Orinsky, who in recent literature known to me, is the only scholar who has discussed the specific question of this paper in any definitive way, suggests that the discrepancy we have noted in itself is a rather common error. He says, scholarship has been virtually unanimous in the belief, more correctly in taking it for granted, that the last three verses in chapter 52 and all of 53 constitute a single composition. There are several cogent reasons for questioning this quite gratuitous assumption. He regards the proper answer to this question as the first problem that needs to be solved as one approaches the interpretation of the fourth service psalm. He states the question thus, do the last three verses of chapter 52, written along with chapter 53, to constitute a single unit with the one servant involved? He answers the question in negative. Since Orinsky is the one who has most recently attempted to enumerate the cogent reasons for questioning this quite gratuitous assumption of scholarship since Doom, we shall list his reasons, though we are really interested in a further consideration of only two of them. The first is the very first phrase of 52:13 in A, Eop, Behold, my servant will prosper, indicates through the pun, Yahshio Yisrael, that it is the people of Israel, that is, the servant here. Two, independently and at the same time bearing out the equation, Yahshio equals Israel, the expression, powerful nations, Goyim Rabin and King Malachim, in verse 15, as also the description of the woebegone servant in verse 14 points to the people of Israel rather than to an individual person as the servant. The second Isaiah employs such terms as nation and king only in contrast to the people of Israel. Three, the situation is quite different in chapter 53. Nothing is said there of nations and kings. The treatment is entirely individualistic. Four, as a matter of fact, closer examination of the last three verses of 52 in relation to what precedes will reveal that they constitute a suitable ending for all of chapter 52. The entire chapter, actually the scene, begins already in 51, is a proclamation and exhortation to Zion and Jerusalem to prepare for the triumphant return of the exiles, a triumph even greater than the exodus from Egypt. It is with this dramatic proclamation that our section is to be associated. God, the greatest servant, his people Israel, will astonish everyone by the great restoration Yahweh will achieve. 5. As for the very few verbal similarities between 52:13-15 and 53:1-12, they help to indicate why 53:1 and following was placed after 52:13-15. They do not, however, prove that the two sections constitute a single unit. 6. It has been noted, as against the rather late chapter division, Jewish tradition begins the section with 52:13 to the end of 53. However, neither the one division nor the other, when the two traditions fail to agree, is automatically to be followed. Each instance has to be decided on its own merits. Interestingly, the complete Isaiah scroll treats both 52:13 and 53:1 as the end of section. With varying degrees of significance, I find the six cogent reasons of Lorenzi persuasive. In presenting reasons 1, 3, 5, and 6, he has, it seems to me, said what can and needs to be said. In connection with reasons 2 and 4, the conclusions of my research, while they are identical with Lorenzi's, are based on significant evidence that he does not present. It's my intent to present this evidence, which, in my opinion, supports the probability that 52:13-15 was originally connected with his preceding context. Reason 2 of Orlinsky deals with the usage of related words and concepts. Reason 4 deals with the structure of chapters 51 and 52. I would like to present the material in reverse order because, for me, the structural evidence leads to further consideration of the conceptual. I shall first discuss in some detail the specific structure of chapters 51 and 52. Then indicate how this section fits into the structure of 40-52 as I conceive that structure. I will then take up the conceptual development in 40-52 and the part that 52:13-15 plays in this self-development. There's no debate about the fact that the thought unit that ends somewhere in chapter 52 begins with 51:9. Westerman is represented. He asserts that 51:9 to 52:3 is a single, consciously designed unit. It consists of three parts, each beginning with a double imperative, like 40, verse 1. He regards 52:4-6 as a block, of which verses 5, B, and 6 exhibit such textual corruption that they are incomprehensible. He describes 52:7-10 as a responsory to 51:9-52:3. His theory of eschatological hymns apparently moves him to discuss this section separately, though he admits it is conceptually related to what precedes. He views 52:11-12, also beginning with double imperatives, as a separate unit containing the command to depart from Babylon, the point towards which, quote, the entire message of literal Isaiah has been reading up, unquote. If 51:9 to 52:3 is a unit, and the definitive thing about the structuring of the unit is that its three sections begin with double imperatives, it seems to me that 52:10 and following, which also begins with a double imperative, may have been a part of that unit. I think that 51:9 to 52:11 at least belong together and comprises a unit consisting of four distinct parts. Each part begins with a double imperative. As I approach this section, the most probable structure that suggests itself is 51:9-16, beginning with a double imperative, 51:17-23, beginning with a double imperative, 52:1-10, beginning with a double imperative, and 52:11 to whatever you choose, also beginning with a double imperative. As I analyze each part of this structure, I discover that the small unit beginning with the double imperative in 51:9-11 and addressed to Yahweh's arm, is followed in 51:12-16 by a prophetic saying which apparently is intended as an answer to the preceding six. The same phenomenon occurs in the next unit, 51:17-23. The address to Jerusalem, 17:21, is followed by a prophetic saying of assurance to Jerusalem, 22:23. Likewise, the revelation to Zion in 52:1-2 is followed by a prophetic saying to Zion. The occurrence of this pattern three times, address, related saying, suggests that one should look for this pattern in 52:11-15. When one does, he discovers that the address in 52:11-12 is followed by the prophetic saying in 13:15. The extent of the unit that seems most probable, therefore, is 51:9-52:15 structured thus. 51:9-11 address, 12:16 say. 51:17-21 address, 22:23 say. 51:1-2 address, 3:7-10 say. 52:11-12 address, 13:15 say. This, if it is a correct analysis of the structure, indicates that 52:13-15 is structurally a part of the material that precedes it. In my opinion, the only difficulty in the structuring of 51:9-52:15 is 52:4-6. It, as most commentators suggest, exhibits the characteristics of a post-exilic law intended to interpret 52:3 from the perspective of the Sinai covenant. We shall, in the next section, discuss the development of thought in this section to demonstrate that 52:13-15 makes good sense as the conclusion to this section, indeed as the conclusion to 40-52. But before we turn to the presentation of the thought development, we would indicate the outline of these 13 chapters that we would suggest. In this discussion, though he is not always representative, we can probably best employ Westman's analysis and outline to present a representative description of the structure of these chapters. In the debate whether 40-55 is a carefully written document or a collection of separate sayings of the second Isaiah, Westman represents, I think correctly, the second view. In the debate whether there is intentional thought development or a random arrangement in the written form of the collection of sayings, Westman favors, again I think correctly, the first view. Though he does not specifically discuss 40-52 from the perspective of an outline, one would derive about the following outline from what he says. 40:1-11, the legitimation and summary of the prophet's message. 40:12-41:29, saying concerning Yahweh. 42:1-45:7-8, a collection of sayings in clearly discernible literary form. 45:9-48:22, a collection of sayings where literary forms are mixed or combined to construct larger literary units whose emphasis is Israel's relief. 49:1-52:12, a collection of sayings exhibiting the same characteristics whose emphasis is Zion's restoration. Of some significance in Westman's understanding of the structure of these chapters is his isolation of several eschatological hymns. The first is 42:10-13, which he describes as a concluding response to 42:1-9, the first reworked sermon song. The second is 44:23, which he describes as a concluding response to 42:14-44:22. The third is 45:8, which he describes as a concluding response to the Cyrus work. The fourth is 48:20-21, which he describes as a concluding response to 45:9-48:19. The fifth is 49:13, which he describes as a response to the second reworked sermon song. The sixth is 52:7-10, which he describes as a concluding response to 49:14-52:3. According to this analysis of structure, 52:11-12, the command to depart from Babylon, stands outside and apart from 41:52:10. He describes this final operation order, depart, depart, as the thing to which the entire message of Deuteronomy has been leading up. While this is an interesting attempt to demonstrate that there is intentional structure in chapters 40-52, its persuasiveness depends on the propriety of his categorizing the aforementioned sections as eschatological hymns and assigning to them the function of concluding responses to significant things or to significant collections of things. In my opinion, the literary form eschatological hymn as described by Westerman is an invention of Westerman, not of Deuteronomy. Though there is no consensus on the proper interpretation of the sections Westerman assigned to this form of category, persuasive interpretations of these sections that differ from Westerman have been suggested. 42:10-13 is more often treated together with 14:17 as a formal unit. 44:23 and 45:8 have been described as an introductory and concluding hymn-like framework to the Cyrus Oracle, 44:24-45:7. 48:20-21 is regarded by most commentators as a command, like 52:11-12, to depart for battle. Mackenzie is representative and, in my opinion, has discerned the intent of this correctly, though he, in spite of this, treats chapter 48 as a thought unit. He says, the poem, that is chapter 48, concludes with a violent change of tone. From rebuke and grief, the prophet turns to exaltation. The hour of liberation has arrived, and he summons Israel to depart. The summons is couched in terms of a call to a new exodus and a passage through the desert, a theme used in the preceding poem. A similar call is repeated in 52:11-12. Each call marks a division in the series of discourse. As we have indicated, 52:7-10, in the pattern of 51:9-52:15, with verse 3, is a saying in response to 52:1-2. This leaves 49:13 as the sole example of an eschatological hymn that may fulfill the function Westerman ascribes to this literary form. I agree with Westerman that 40-52 is a collection of the sayings of the second Isaiah, which he delivers separately and orally. I agree that these sayings have been preserved in a written collection that exhibits some intentional self-development, but I would suggest a different structure to indicate this development. 41-11, the legitimation and summary of the prophet's message. 40:12-41:29, saying concerning Yahweh, the God of Israel. 42:1-44:22, saying concerning Israel, the servant of Yahweh. 44:23-48:16, saying concerning Cyrus, Yahweh's agent for Israel's relief. And 48:17-52:15, saying concerning the return and restoration of Israel's army. The final collection begins and ends with the command to depart from Babylon, which was, in the thought of Deuteronomy, the first and last commandment for every faithful God. This suggestion concerning the structure of this collective is not meant to imply that there is no overlapping of ideas between sections. It merely intends to suggest that this was the blueprint for arranging the same with which the preserver of these materials operated. It does not mean to imply that everything in 48:17 to 52:15 was proclaimed by the prophet after Cyrus was accepted as suzerain of Babylon and issued the decree authorizing the return, but to suggest that the prophet delivered some of these things and the preserver and arranger of these things worked in that situation. The clearest indication that the return propaganda, 48:17 through 52:15, is an integral part of Deutero-Isaiah's message is the fact that the idea is included in the summary of his message in 41-11, namely in verses 9-11. This outline is intended to assert that I would confidently ascribe the production of the materials in chapters 40-52 to the Isaiah of the Exile. I have not reached a definite conclusion as to whether the preserver of the materials is the Isaiah of the Exile or the Isaiah of the Return, as to whether they are the same person or different persons, though I tend to regard the latter as the better solution in both cases, or as to whether 53-55 belong to the Isaiah of the Exile or the Return. However, the solution to these questions is not necessary in determining and describing the structure of 40-52. We now turn to the discussion of the thought development, beginning with 51:9 to 52:15. The first unit, 51:9 to 16, consists of the address Yahweh-Har, 9-11, and the response to this address, 12-16. The address is a prophetic interjection. The prophet begins by requesting Yahweh's arm to go into action. He describes significant actions of the arm in the past. It created the earth by smiting Rahab, and it delivered Israel by drying up the sea. He describes what he wants his arm to do now, namely affect the return of the people of Yahweh that they may come to Zion. Though there are textual difficulties in verses 12 and 16, verses 13 to 16 exhibit the form of divine reply to the prophet's prayer. Comments suggest changing the second person plural in verse 12 to singular form so that this verse corresponds with the rest of the saying. This textual change makes verses 12 to 14 intelligible. Here Yahweh declares, "Since I, the only God, am your comforter, why do you fear men, stand in awe of the fury of those who oppress you, with the result that you forget me, the one who stretched out the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth?" Then by means of rhetorical question, Yahweh asserts that the fury of the prophet's oppressors has been dissipated so that he will not die, and his sap will not dry up, and he will experience relief. In their present arrangement, verses 15 and 16 present the obvious theological problem of ascribing the creation of heaven and earth to the prophet. I will translate verse 16 as it stands, "And I put my words in your mouth and covered you with the shadow of my hand to stretch out the heavens, to found the earth, and to say to Zion, you are my people." I cannot solve this theological problem except by suggesting the rearrangement of the text. I would suggest the following. "I am Yahweh your God," 15a, "who stretched out the heavens, who laid the foundations of the earth," 16b, "who stirred up the sea so that its waves roared, Yahweh Sabaoth is my name," 15b, "I have put my words in your mouth and covered you with the shadow of my hand so that you say to Zion, you are my people." Whether one chooses to grapple with theological problems of the prophets creating heaven and earth rather than changing the text or not, the import of the saying as it relates to the prophet's present situation is clear. The rebuke of the prophet's fear of men and the promise of his release from oppression is substantiated by the assertion that he is the angel of Yahweh, that he has been given his message and he is protected by Yahweh. However, the connection between 9 to 11 and 12 to 16 is not immediately obvious. Precisely how this rebuke of encouragement to and validation of the prophet is intended to serve as the answer to his intercession to Yahweh's arm is not clear. But we can leave that difficulty for the moment, take the content of the other part where the connection is more obvious, then return to the solution of this problem that is suggested by the entire unit. The next part, 15:17-23, is divided into two sections. 17-20 or 21, the address to Jerusalem by the prophet, and 21 or 22-23, the divine saying addressed to Jerusalem. In the first part, addressed to Jerusalem for conflict, Israel is depicted as an alcoholic in a dazed, hungover state, which resulted from her drinking the wine of the cup of Yahweh's wrath. In this alcoholic stupor, there is no one to comfort her because all of her children disappeared as a result of her being punished. But this drunken one is encouraged to rouse herself from this condition, which was not the result of drinking real wine, and to hearken to the word from her God. Then the word Yahweh addresses is, I have removed the cup from you, you will not drink it again. I have transferred it to your tormentor and oppressor. It is obvious that this section, though in two parts, is a conceptual unit. Its two parts were never separate from one another. It was composed, proclaimed, and preserved as a unit. The third part is divided into two sections, but the structure has probably been disturbed by the late law. If the divine sayings in 3 to 10 were original, then the poetic form of the one in 4 to 6 has been expanded by later editions. I consider the theory that the divine sayings 3 and 7 to 10 has been expanded by the later edition of the saying in 4 to 6 as the best solution to the textual difficulties here. If this is correct, this section originally consisted of the address to Zion, 52, 1 and 2, and the divine response, 52, 3 and 7 to 10. To appreciate the intended connection here, one has to see that Zion and Jerusalem is presented from two perspectives in verses 1 and 2. In verse 1, Zion is conceived of as the temple complex and Jerusalem as a holy city from which the uncircumcised and unclean are barred. In verse 2, Zion and Jerusalem is conceived of as a captive, exiled people. In the divine saying, confirming the prophet's address to Zion and Jerusalem, verses 3 and 10 are words for exiled people, assuring them their release will not require their payment of a ransom, and that Yahweh's deed of delivering them will be performed in the view of all people. Verses 7 to 9 are addressed to Zion and Jerusalem, conceived of as a city and temple complex. In 7 and 8, Zion is assured by heralds and watchmen that Yahweh will once again dwell in her and exercise dominion from her, for he is returning to Zion. In verse 9, Jerusalem is assured that her ruins will be restored by those whom Yahweh has comforted, and she will be delivered from her ruined state, just as Yahweh's people will be redeemed from their exile condition. Again, the connection between the prophet's address and the divine word of confirmation is obvious. However, 52, 1 and 2, and 52, 3 and 7 to 10 could have existed as separate sayings. This brings us to the fourth part, where again we discern a prophetic address, 11 and 12, and a divine say confirming that address, 13 to 15. The imperative address, though we do not want to prove too much by this, is in the second person, or second masculine plural. In the form of the text that has been transmitted to us, the command is not addressed to Yahweh's arms, to Jerusalem, or to Zion, the addressees of the other imperative. In fact, while it soon becomes obvious who the addressees are, the bearers of the vessels of Yahweh, 11b, exiles returning with Yahweh as man and rear guard, 12b, they are not identified until we get to the divine say, where they are specifically called Yahweh's servants. As the prophet addresses the servant of Yahweh, using the second masculine plural form, he directs them to leave Babylon, to leave behind every idol, to purify themselves that they may be fit bearers of the vessels of Yahweh. He forbids them to sneak away as if afraid, because Yahweh is accompanying them to protect them. This command, and I think that it is going to be a command to depart from Babylon, is followed by a divine say, which, though not introduced by the messenger formula, is obviously presented as a word of Yahweh. In this confirming word, Yahweh promises that his servant Israel, which has suffered inhuman humiliation, will experience superhuman exaltation. Israel's success and exaltation will be so great that it will attract the attention of nations and kings who previously had never heard of Israel and Yahweh, the God of Israel, who saved his people. Again, the connection between the prophetic address and the confirming response is obvious. The prophet says, depart. Yahweh confirms the imperative by declaring, this one small step for Israel will be a giant leap for mankind. I would not care to assert that verses 11 and 12 could not have been proclaimed separately from 13 to 15, but I do feel that they are intimately related in the present structure of the unit. So, in the total unit of thought, there is one part, 17 to 23 of 51, where the prophet's address and the divine response apparently were never separate. There are two parts, 52:1 to 10 and 52:11 to 15, where the prophet's address is and the divine response may have been proclaimed separately, but appear intimately related in their present arrangement. There is one part, 51:9 to 16, where the prophetic address and the divine response are not clearly related conceptually. It was customary in the pre-exilic cult, whose liturgical practices greatly influenced Deutero and Pre-Isaiah, that a petition of intercession be followed by an assurance or announcement of salvation. If the collector of the sayings of Deutero-Isaiah was influenced by this custom in the structuring of the total unit, he may have felt the necessity to use an available saying of the prophet, and 12 to 16 seems to fit better with 9 to 11 than any other available saying. Whatever the origin and transmission of the two sayings, I think in the situation I have suggested for the collector, some meaning can be discerned in their being connected in this unit. The prophet who addressed the petition to Yahweh's arm is assured that Yahweh has already acted in a significant way by putting his words into the prophet's mouth, by protecting him in such a way that he has been able to announce his message of comfort, forgiveness, and deliverance to Israel. Yahweh's act of revealing his plan of deliverance to this prophet is a certain prelude to the action of his arm for which the prophet acts. This arm will perform what was revealed to the prophet in the view of all the peoples of the earth, 52:10, so that the nations and kings will perceive in that action the saving will and ability of Yahweh that they have not comprehended before, 52:15. I therefore agree with Orlinsky's fourth observation. As a matter of fact, a closer examination of the last three verses of 52 in relation to what we see will reveal that they constitute a suitable ending for all of chapter 52. Interpreted thus, 52:11-15 is a fitting conclusion to 40-52. Before we indicate the correct phase of which this unit is comprised and briefly describe the message, we call your attention to the one correct phase in this entire unit that is most closely related to 52:13-15, and explain my interpretation of it. It is the periphrase that includes what is usually referred to as the second servant song, namely 49:1-6. In this song, as the text has been transmitted to us, the servant is designated as Israel in 49:3. The invitation of Israel to the people to listen in 49:1-8 is followed by the affirmation that Israel has been called and equipped as servant and protected by Yahweh, up to verse 4. This is followed by the affirmation that Yahweh has enlarged its path to include not only the restoration of Israel, but also the revelation of Yahweh's kingdom purposes to the ends of the earth, 49:5-6. These affirmations of Israel are confirmed by a divine word. Thus says Yahweh, the deliverer and holy one of Israel, to one deeply despised, abhorred by nations, the servant of rulers, that is, Israel in exile, kings shall see you and arise, princes shall see or come to you and prostrate themselves, because of Yahweh who is faithful, the holy one of Israel, who chose you. This confirming word assures exiled Israel that it will be successful in its task of restoring Israel and being a light to the nation. This is followed by another confirming divine saying in which the restoration of exiled Israel, 18:11, and of dispersed Israel, verse 12, is promised. Though one cannot deny that 49:1-6, perhaps even without Israel in verse 3, may have been proclaimed as a separate saying by the prophet, I think it is necessary to assert that 49:1-12 is a literary unit produced by the collector, perhaps by bringing together three separate sayings of the prophet. But the point is that verses 7 and 8:12 are at present too closely related to 1-6 to deny that the connection is intentional. Everything said about the servant in 52:13-15 has already been said about the servant in 49:1-12, where the servant is designated as Israel. On the basis of this parakeia alone, I would agree with Orlinsky's second observation. The expression nations and kings in verse 15, as also the description of the woebegone servant in verse 14, point to the people Israel rather than to an individual person as the servant. Israel will be exceedingly exalted and honored after shocking the mighty with its wretched condition by the same powerful nations and kings who would never have believed possible that they will themselves see and hear. I'd also like to suggest that there's another similarity between 49:1-12 and 52:13-15. Both are preceded by a command to depart from Babylon, 48:17-21 and 52:11-12. In the former instance, it is introduced by the assertion that Yahweh had always taught his people what to do and led them in the way that they should go. This is followed by the motivational statement, if Israel had only listened to Yahweh's instruction, they would have experienced perpetual well-being, deliverance, abundance of prosperity, and absence of affliction. This introduction to the command to depart in 48:20-21 makes it clear that the prophet before guarded his order leave Babylon as the condition for present faithfulness to Yahweh and the means by which his hearers could personally initiate and cooperate with Yahweh in his saving plan for all men. Since my time is up, I will not go into detail about the outline of the according to 52, but stop with this affirmation that you have the same kind of thing in 48:17 to 49:12 that you have in 52:11 to 15. So.